Today I'm going to talk about, I've divided my stroke lecture into two parts. I think the cerebral hemorrhage section is of much more interest for you, even though ischemic stroke is really much more common than hemorrhagic stroke, at least in Western populations. When you go to Southeast Asia, of course, the balance changes, and intracerebral hemorrhage and subarachnoid hemorrhage are as common as, or arguably a little more common than ischemic infarct. But today I'm going to talk about ischemic stroke, talk about large vessel disease, small vessel disease, and the consequences for the brain. You know the way neurologists like to define and redefine things, so there's a kind of a historical definition of stroke which was used prior to the days of neuroimaging, especially MRI scanning. And then when MRI came along, it was obvious that we could pick up infarcts in the brain that were much smaller than would be symptomatic necessarily, and much smaller than could be picked up by CT scanning. So the definition of stroke has really been redefined, and there's going to be a new document coming out from the American Heart Association in stroke sometime in the next few months, which will be a new definition of stroke, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Historically, or hysterically, when I was a resident, just when neuroimaging was coming in, CT scanning was beginning, we had a purely clinical definition of stroke, and it was defined as a rapidly progressive, irreversible, non-convulsive neurologic deficit. And when it's caused by cerebrovascular disease, it usually results from an infarct, most commonly, or an intraparenchymal or intracerebral hemorrhage. The new definition of stroke that is coming from the American Heart Association, and I'm part of the panel that was involved with redefining stroke. I was charged with writing the neuropathology part of it. So there's going to be an updated definition of stroke for the 21st century, and I think the manuscript has just been submitted to stroke. It's kind of a huge document. And it really subdivides acute stroke into CNS infarct, obviously. There are many things that can cause stroke, four things in particular: intracerebral, intraparenchymal hemorrhage, subarachnoid hemorrhage, or cerebral venous thrombosis. Now you might say, why have they left epidural and subdural hematomas off the list? The reason is that even those are intracranial types of intracranial hemorrhage, they're usually associated with trauma. So it was the feeling of the panel that was doing this updated definition that we would leave epidural and subdural hematomas off the list and leave those to the consideration of traumatic brain injury. Then there was the very important issue of silent stroke, because we know not all strokes are symptomatic. And when you look at using very high resolution MRI scanning at large populations, particularly at risk populations for vascular disease and elderly, it's quite obvious that quite commonly we see silent brain infarcts. And depending on the study, it can be seen, silent brain infarcts can be seen in as many as 8 to 28% of individuals. Especially the populations being studied are particularly selected for individuals with vascular risk factors, smoking, aged, hypertensive individuals. And more important, and very importantly also, silent cerebral hemorrhage. Now those cerebral hemorrhages are not necessarily large. We know now, for example, that microhemorrhages are a pretty well accepted marker for the presence of amyloid angiopathy in individuals beyond 70 or 75 years of age. In fact, there's a big debate in the stroke literature and in the dementia literature as to what the significance of microhemorrhages is. Are they overestimated using high resolution MRI scanning? Is their size overestimated? Is their significance overestimated? Nevertheless, small cerebral hemorrhages or microbleeds in the brain, MBs in the brain, are accepted as a pretty reliable marker of the presence of amyloid angiopathy and aging. So there's acute clinical stroke and there are silent strokes that are considered. What is the new definition of CNS infarction coming from the American Heart Association? So it will now be defined as a rapidly evolving clinical signs of focal brain, spinal cord, and or retinal dysfunction without an apparent cause except of vascular origin, and either neuroimaging or neuropathologic evidence of brain, spinal cord, or retinal ischemia in a defined vascular distribution, or neurologic symptoms persisting for at least 24 hours with other etiologies excluded. So tumor or an abscess, an infectious process excluded. So that's going to be the new American Heart Association approved definition of an ischemic infarct or an ischemic stroke. I always show this picture to show that in actual autopsy material, an ischemic infarct can often be difficult to tell from a resorbed hemorrhage. And the reason I show this is that this actually was from an individual who, by clinical history and by neuroimaging, actually had putaminal hemorrhage some years before he died. And so that cystic cavity you see in the left basal ganglia with the compensatory enlargement of the left lateral ventricle, although it looks like an area of cystic necrosis, was actually resorbed hemorrhage from a fairly small intraparenchymal bleed. And that had been well documented using MRI scanning and CT scanning. So when we look at an old cystic cavity at autopsy, we usually use a very generic term for it. We describe it as an area of cystic encephalomalacia. We don't make any judgment as to the etiology of the lesion, but we do try to correlate it, obviously, with the clinical history. And in this case, the cavity was that of the cavity resulted from a resorbed old cerebral hemorrhage. Could it be an infarct? It certainly could. We know that there are ganglionic infarcts, but they're usually lacunar infarcts rather than large cystic cavities of this type. This is a no-brainer, so to speak. This is actually a large intraparenchymal hematoma in the right superior frontal lobe. And you can see there's actually, it actually dissects into the subarachnoid space. And we know that this is quite common in amyloid angiopathy-related bleeds. And this, in fact, was an amyloid angiopathy-related hemorrhage in an elderly individual with extension into the subcortical white matter and into the overlying subarachnoid space. Now, you might say, knowing the biology of amyloid angiopathy, I'm not sure why this is advancing on its own, but it is. You know from the biology of amyloid angiopathy that that's really a purely meningocortical microangiopathy. So it does not involve white matter vessels. In fact, if you looked at a histologic section in which a vessel is cut in longitudinal section that goes from the cortex into the white matter, you will know that that amyloid in the vessel wall basically ends at the subcortical white matter. So it's a purely cortical microangiopathy, but the hemorrhages often will dissect into the brain parenchyma, the underlying white matter. That might be because it's kind of the path of least resistance. And again, that movement into the subarachnoid space is very common in amyloid angiopathy-related bleeds. Remember that there is the issue of a diffuse anoxic ischemic encephalopathy, which kind of interfaces with an ischemic infarct in the brain. And what you're seeing is the brain on the right here, of an individual who had a cardiac arrest, cardiopulmonary arrest, was asystolic for about 10 or 12 minutes and then was resuscitated. And he suffered severe irreversible anoxic ischemic brain injury. So the brain on the left is a control brain cut on the same day, normal cortical ribbon, normal subcortical white matter. And what you can see by contrast is the brain on the right from the individual who had severe anoxic ischemic encephalopathy and survived for about a week or 2 weeks, has very, very marked thinning of the cortex. And this was really not just laminar necrosis of the cortex, this was really pancortical necrosis, very marked thinning of the cortex. But one thing that's interesting about anoxic ischemic encephalopathy is that it doesn't involve all areas of the cortex uniformly, right? So if you look at this, I know the orientation of the specimen is a little bit weird, but here are the basal ganglia, here's the lentiform nucleus, the internal capsule, the insular cortex, and you can see the insular cortex is almost totally spared, whereas the superior frontal cortex is severely involved. And anoxic ischemic change can often be especially severe at the watershed between the anterior and the middle cerebral arteries, and this is kind of a watershed zone here. So this is what diffuse anoxic ischemic encephalopathy, or at least multifocal anoxic ischemic encephalopathy looks like abnormal brain on the right, normal brain on the left. Now you might say, what turns anoxic ischemic encephalopathy, or when would we call it that as opposed to an ischemic infarct? To call it an ischemic infarct, we generally would like to see cystic cavitation in the brain and an area of encephalomalacia so that there's actually damage or injury of the neuropil. Just a reminder that there are certain areas of the brain that are vulnerable to anoxic ischemic encephalopathy. And remember that the patterns differ between adults and infants. So in newborns, the neocortex is remarkably resistant to anoxic ischemic change for whatever reason, but the hippocampal formations are vulnerable. In infants, the deep central gray matter, the thalami, are quite vulnerable. And there are regions of the brainstem, especially the midbrain, and the midbrain tegmentum, or midbrain tectum, that are at risk for anoxic ischemic change, and those tend to be resistant in an adult. In an adult, it would be very rare for us to see anoxic ischemic change in the brainstem or the spinal cord, although we do see it, and people have a profound hypoxic episode, whereas in infants and children, it's a little bit more common. By contrast, in adults, the cerebellar Purkinje cells are remarkably sensitive to anoxia and will show eosinophilic neuronal change, even when in an infant a comparable anoxic insult will not affect the cerebellar cortex. So different patterns of vulnerability between adults and infants, especially newborn infants. And remember the sequence of neuronal changes that occurs when a neuron is rendered anoxic. And that occurs whether it's rendered anoxic because of a global hypoxic insult or hypoxic ischemic insult, or whether there is a focal anoxic insult resulting from the cessation of blood flow to a portion of the brain. The initial change we see is the eosinophilic neuronal change, the so-called red dead neurons, collapse of the nuclei with loss of the nucleolated nucleus, and occasionally polymorphonuclear leukocytes that will move into that infarct. Within about 3 or 4 days, macrophages will move into the infarct, and those will be a combination of macrophages that are derived from bloodborne monocytes and microglial cells that can transform into macrophages. And many of those macrophages will persist in an infarct or an ischemic cystic cavity for the life of the patient, and we will see them even if the infarct occurred 10 or 15 years before the death. And then there will be a dense glial margin around the infarct. And occasionally, some neurons at the edge of the infarct will become mummified. That tends to be especially common in children, so that you'll see large encrusted neurons containing calcium and iron on their membranes. So a big cystic cavity lined by reactive astrocytes. Just to show you neuronal anoxic ischemic change, this is relatively normal. These are relatively normal neurons. They normally have the nice basophilic cytoplasm. That basophilia is imparted to the neuron by the presence of rough endoplasmic reticulum, which tends to be very basophilic. By contrast, this is what eosinophilic neuronal change looks like. So the neuronal cell bodies are bright pink, and this actually is a region of cortex that is developing an infarct with cystic cavitation in the surrounding brain. When we see an old cystic cavity, an old cystic infarct, this is usually what it looks like. This is a fragment of, I think it was temporal lobe, and somebody who had multiple infarcts in the brain had severe atherosclerosis. And here you see this large cystic cavity involving the cortex and the underlying subcortical white matter. And what you'll see at a higher magnification when I show you this is that there are still large numbers of macrophages here. This individual by history had severe atherosclerosis and had been suffering infarcts for many years prior to death. But there were still large numbers of macrophages in that cystic cavity. Notice this very characteristic feature of an ischemic infarct, and that is that layer one of the cortex overlying the ischemic infarct tends to be preserved. And here you see that at a higher magnification. So here is the subarachnoid space, here is layer one of the cortex, and here is the underlying cystic cavity, which is full of macrophages. You might say, and I would agree with you, that this layer one of the cortex is not normal. It seems to be intensely gliotic, but nevertheless, the actual scaffolding of layer one of the cortex remains behind. And there are many reasons that are postulated to explain that. One is that it's a relatively neuron-free layer, so that it's not vulnerable to an infarct. The other is that it might develop, might obtain some of its nutrients from the subarachnoid space directly, so it's not as dependent on blood supply as the underlying neurons in the cortex are. But in any event, that preservation of layer one of the cortex is very characteristic of an ischemic infarct. Now you might say, can we see a cause for that infarct if we look at the blood vessels overlying and in the infarct? And in fact, very often in an old cerebral infarct, we have trouble finding occluded vessels. Once in a while, we might find atheroemboli, and I'll show you an example of that. But that's actually the exception rather than the rule. So what causes ischemic infarcts in the brain? There might be basal atherosclerosis, but more commonly, there is cervical atherosclerosis. And this is actually, you can tell it's an old picture because it's from my residency days at Victoria Hospital in London, not London, England, but London, Canada. Not far from where Dr. Osman actually worked, I think in Detroit, is that right, Jim? And we used to routinely dissect out the cervical vessels in people who had had ischemic infarcts. This was the directive of Henry Barnett and our head of neuropathology, who was very interested in stroke pathophysiology. And this is actually the carotid bifurcation, and this is the internal carotid artery. And you can see that the carotid bifurcation is just totally atherosclerotic and is occluded as a result of that. And then there is there's actually thrombosis of the internal carotid artery. And this person had severe atherosclerosis in all of the cervical vessels. As Neil Martin always says, this is where all those Big Macs and quarter pounders end up, is in that atherosclerotic plaque. And if you take a section of that, this is what the atheromatous material looks like in the carotid bifurcation. So this, I believe, was the external carotid artery. And actually, the atheroma is so severe here that it's actually shattered in the course of the section being cut. So this external carotid was really totally occluded. In the internal carotid artery, you still see a pinpoint lumen. But if you were estimating the degree of stenosis here, you would estimate this at being 80 to 85% stenosed. But interestingly enough, even in this severely atherosclerotic vessel, the lining of that pinpoint lumen still appears to be relatively intact. The endothelium appears to be normal. It's not ulcerated. There are no mural thrombi here, but very often we do find, of course, mural thrombi and carotid endarterectomies that are removed at surgery. Now, you might, obviously, one of the mechanisms for ischemic infarct in these individuals is that this atheromatous material is really fairly fragile. The atheromatous plaque can become ulcerated, and that ulceration can cause one of two things. Either atheromatous material can embolize distally into the cerebral circulation until those atheroemboli encounter a vessel that they can't get through anymore, then they'll occlude that vessel and produce ischemic necrosis, or the ulcerated plaque can be the nidus for mural thrombus. And so you can get platelet fibrin material forming on even a much smaller plaque than this, and those platelet fibrin emboli can embolize distally. So those then become artery-to-artery emboli. So you can get either atheroemboli or platelet fibrin emboli that embolize distally. And we always look for these in people with severe atherosclerotic cerebrovascular disease, and once in a while we find them. So this was actually, unfortunately, a fairly young individual in his 50s, at least young for me, who had multiple infarcts, multiple ischemic infarcts, and multiple vascular territories in the brain. And he'd been progressing in kind of a stuttering way, so that he would develop progressive neurologic deficits that almost looked like a progressive neurodegenerative disorder, so that the brain was actually removed as a possible Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease brain. But it was obvious when we cut the brain that he had numerous infarcts in the brain. And when we looked at them microscopically, we could see that atheromatous material in many meningeal vessels, and the underlying brain showed extensive necrosis. As I say, we don't see this in every case of an ischemic infarct, even when there is severe cervical atherosclerosis, but we did in this case. And these large clefts that you're seeing in the lumen are really cholesterol clefts, because cholesterol is dissolved out by the tissue processing. Cholesterol is very xylene and alcohol soluble. So all you really see is the space left by the cholesterol cleft, and you see a few multinucleated giant cells. But this unfortunate man's vessels were extensively occluded in multiple vessel territories by this atheroemboli. Does anyone remember what the name is for? You can actually see these cholesterol or atheromatous plaques that actually migrate through the retina once in a while. Anyone remember what those are called? Hollandhorst plaques. Very good. Okay. Now, we often find atheroma in the vessels at the base of the circle of Willis, and we're quite interested in that, especially in our dementia patients, where we actually take multiple sections of the basilar and middle cerebral arteries. And this is a very characteristic pattern of atheroma in the basal vessels. I think this was the basilar artery. Again, less stenotic than the internal carotid that I showed you. This one is maybe 60 to 70% stenosed. And again, the endothelium looks relatively intact. But very characteristically, in basal atherosclerosis, you see tremendous amounts of lipid and grumous material and necrosis in the depths of the plaque. And then you see a rim of smooth muscle cells that overlie that material that's sitting deep within the plaque. And this would seem to be a relatively stable plaque. And actually, basal atherosclerosis is quite infrequently the cause of ischemic infarcts in the brain, unless it ulcerates or unless it undergoes thrombosis. For example, if a middle cerebral artery stem undergoes necrosis, or the basilar artery undergoes thrombosis. So this is a very characteristic pattern for atherosclerosis of the basal arteries on the circle of Willis. This is another artery from another patient showing again that same pattern. There's a huge amount of necrotic material in this atheromatous plaque, and overlying it is a smooth muscle cell hyperplasia. But again, the lumen is relatively, the lumen is not lined by any ulcerations or mural thrombi. And even though the lumen is severely compromised, and you would think there would have been very markedly decreased blood flow to the brain, you still see that the lumen is patent. And this just happens to be postmortem blood in the lumen of the vessel. Occasionally, meningeal arteries can be involved by atherosclerosis, so that is unusual. In what population is there a tendency for the meningeal arteries to be involved by atherosclerosis? In the Asian population. In fact, if you look at very nice studies from the Honolulu Asian Aging Study, which has been going on, I think, since the 1950s or 60s, where they look very carefully at the basal and the meningeal vessels, patients there very commonly get severe meningeal atherosclerosis as well, again, with a very tiny pinpoint lumen, and you can actually see the internal elastic lamina of the artery here, and the underlying brain isn't very happy. The underlying brain has undergone ischemic necrosis. Occasionally, you can get microatheroma in people who are severely hypertensive and have vascular risk factors. You can see microatheroma even in the basal ganglia and the deep gray structures. You can actually recognize this as being a bit of basal ganglia. A small parenchymal artery, it should have scale markers on here, but this is probably about 350 micrometers in maximal diameter. And notice you've got really quite a marked degree of atheroma even in this deep ganglionic artery, but still an intact lumen. So the atheroma can extend right from cervical vessels into branches of the circle of Willis, meningeal arteries, and even rarely into parenchymal arteries, although that is quite unusual. How do we recognize infarcts, and what should you know about them in terms of identifying them, for example, on the boards? If they show you an infarct, can you date the infarct? Can you get an approximate idea of how old the infarct is? Well, of course, we go by the clinical history, and obviously we go by the imaging. And this is about a 3 or 3.5 day old infarct, a very large left MCA territory infarct. And you know this is when patients are most vulnerable to die because the cerebral edema is maximal. And these are probably, some of these patients are the ones you do craniectomies on to allow that brain to swell. The rationale for that surgery being if the brain can swell out, that edema will go down, and hopefully the neurologic deficit will go down as well, although probably won't disappear. And then you can replace the calvarium overlying the brain after that that critical period of edema from about 3 to 4 days has subsided. What do these brains look like? This would be the brain of the individual whose MRI scan we just looked at. So a massive left MCA territory infarct. How do we identify it? We identify it by observing the brain that looks like it's kind of falling apart. It's almost to the point of undergoing liquefactive necrosis. But a key thing here is to look for blurring of that cortex white matter junction and for gray discoloration of the underlying white matter. This infarct obviously extends into the deep central gray matter. And this is an infarct that shows maximal edema, so that you actually have subfalcine herniation of the cingulate gyrus. This patient would have been at tremendous risk for compression of the anterior cerebral arteries. And there's actually even severe uncal herniation or uncal grooving here on the left-hand side as well. But notice that areas of the brain that would be supplied by branches of the posterior cerebral artery appear to be relatively intact. So, and indeed, if you look at the anterior cerebral territory, it looks like the cingulate gyrus itself is relatively intact, although the medial and superior aspects of the frontal lobe, which would be supplied by the anterior cerebral territory, look like they're infarcted. So I think this was an internal carotid artery occlusion. So this is the appearance of about a 3 to 4 day old infarct or a subacute infarct. By contrast, this is the appearance of a brain from somebody who had experienced an infarct clinically and by neuroimaging about 3 weeks prior to death. And you can see that there's this large area of liquefactive necrosis in the left middle cerebral territory. So notice now, anterior cerebral territory relatively intact, middle cerebral territory undergoing liquefactive necrosis. In general on the boards, if they show you something, a destructive lesion that fits within a vascular territory or territory of supply, they are showing you an infarct. They should be showing you an infarct. If they show you an area of ischemic necrosis that is placed between two territories of supply or a border zone or watershed region, they want you to make the diagnosis of a watershed infarct, and I think I'll show you a picture of that a little bit later, but this fits right into the middle cerebral artery territory. Is it the only infarct in the brain? No. The arrow on the right demonstrates other infarcts. Once you have vascular risk factors, you're at risk for developing lacunar infarcts, and this individual actually has a large basal ganglia infarct on the right, and even an infarct involving the insular cortex on the right. So multiple cerebral infarcts, and patient had severe atheromatous disease. When we look at a very old infarct at autopsy, you can see it as soon as we unroof the calvarium. There's a large cystic cavity staring you in the face. And this is a large MCA territory infarct involving the left cerebral hemisphere, and this is a large MCA territory infarct involving the right cerebral hemisphere, and this by history had occurred about 10 or 11 years before the patient's death. Now who can tell me what we saw in this individual's brainstem? Anybody? Very good. Willary degeneration involving what? Well, involving the, what would we see in a section of the basis pontus? Well, the corticospinals would show the Willarian degeneration. Which side, right or left?
Ipsilateral side.
Ipsilateral side, absolutely. So you'd see, so what we saw in this case was severe atrophy of the corticospinal tracts on the right, because those corticospinal tracts had undergone degeneration years earlier. So there was shrinkage of the right basis pontus. And we have a picture of this in the big blue Mosby book. Some infarcts are bland, but many infarcts are hemorrhagic. And this actually shows an unfortunate individual who had both anterior cerebral and middle cerebral artery, a very hemorrhagic infarct. And hemorrhagic infarcts characteristically show this extravasation of blood into the cortical ribbon. This infarct, by history, was about 4 or 5 days old. It occurred about 4 or 5 days prior to the patient's death. It's not uniformly hemorrhagic because part of the infarcted brain does not show extravasation of blood into the brain, but it's extensively hemorrhagic. And these are infarcts that are usually caused by an embolus or multiple emboli, often cardiogenic emboli, but sometimes even atheroemboli. And I think in this individual, it was actually atheroemboli from cervical vessels that had caused this infarct. Left cerebral hemisphere, relatively intact. But right cerebral hemisphere, massive hemorrhagic infarct in the middle and anterior cerebral territories. Some other examples of embolic infarcts, one involving the superior cerebellum, probably superior cerebellar artery occlusion, bilateral posterior cerebral artery territories. This individual was jaundiced, so you know whenever you have an infarct in the brain of somebody who's icteric, that dead brain will actually be highlighted a yellow-green color because of the patient's elevated bilirubin. And this is actually a very extensive hemorrhagic infarct involving superior temporal lobe and an inferior frontal region. In this arrow, it's maybe a little bit too low magnification to see that, but we could actually see a small embolus in a branch of the middle cerebral artery territory that had led to this extensive infarct. So hemorrhagic infarcts are usually watershed infarcts or embolic infarcts. You wouldn't deal with lacunar infarcts as much as the neurologists would, but lacunar infarcts, remember, are small deep infarcts in the brain, usually involve the central gray matter, the deep white matter, and the basis pontus. They produce distinctive syndromes depending on the site of the infarct, and there was a famous neurologist in the 1960s and 70s, C. Miller Fisher, who actually made a career of describing all of these or many of these syndromes and showing the pathologic correlations of them. It was kind of the heyday of clinical pathologic correlation. And he named many of these syndromes. In fact, he actually named the vascular lesion that causes them lipohyalinosis, which is really hypertensive microvascular disease. And these are attributed to microvascular disease associated clinically with hypertension and diabetes. But people are starting to question whether there are other risk factors for microvascular disease beyond hypertension and diabetes. And this is what lacunar infarcts look like. They're usually multiple. They are by definition supposed to be smaller than 1 centimeter in size. And quite often they're asymptomatic, but if they impinge on the internal capsule, they'll become symptomatic. And this individual has a large lacunar infarct in the left putamen, the right caudate, the right sort of putamen globus pallidus junction, and this one extended into the internal capsule. And you can see that not only did he have microvascular disease, which he did, but he's got a whopping big atherosclerotic plaque in his middle cerebral artery as well. So we know that obviously the risk factors for macrovascular disease or atherosclerosis are very often risk factors for microvascular disease as well, and he obviously had both. This is what lacunar infarcts look like. This is actually a whole mount section, not from that individual, but this is a section of the basal ganglia, caudate nucleus here, internal capsule, lentiform nucleus or a portion of the lentiform nucleus here. And you can see two things here. One is you can see small infarcts in the basal ganglia. And secondly, you can actually see quite a bit of microatheroma in the small vessels that are present in the basal ganglion. So he did have microatheroma as well. And microscopically, a lacunar infarct really looks, the boundary between the brain and the lacunar infarct really looks similar to the boundary between the tissue surrounding a large cystic infarct and the infarct. So you see gliotic brain parenchyma here, and then you see large fields of macrophages remaining in that cystic cavity. It's just defined really by the size of the infarct. And you can actually see some degree of microvascular disease here in the center of the cystic cavity, although usually when we look for the occluded vessel that caused a lacunar infarct, in practice we don't usually find it. Miller Fisher was able to find it because he would do these very meticulous serial section studies around lacunar infarcts until he found the supposedly the guilty vessel. And it's been suggested that lacunar infarcts may actually be of several types, and they may have several etiologies, and they may not always be caused by microvascular disease. And furthermore, it's been suggested that sometimes they may be the result not of ischemic necrosis in the brain, but actually of microhemorrhages. And so if you see an abundance of old hemorrhage in or at the edge of the lacunar infarct, as you're seeing here, you know that old blood pigment looks sort of a brownish-black color when it's been exposed to formalin. This lacunar infarct may actually have resulted from a small hemorrhage in the basal ganglia. So not only are we now interested in microhemorrhages as a biomarker for amyloid angiopathy in the cortex, but also possibly for hypertensive microvascular disease or arteriolosclerosis in the deep gray matter. There's actually a whole universe of microvascular diseases, but just a reminder that the two most common by far are hypertensive microvascular disease, or what Miller Fisher called lipohyalinosis, and amyloid angiopathy. Those are far and away the two most common types of microvascular disease. And I won't go through all of the panels here, but this really shows a severe degree of arteriolosclerotic microvascular disease. The scale marker here is about 200 micrometers. This is what would be what Miller Fisher would have described as lipohyalinosis, although it's dominated really by the hyalinization of the vessel wall. And you can demonstrate by immunohistochemistry that there's an abundance of collagen and scarring in these vessels, although we don't know exactly why that occurs. This is actually from a surgical specimen. This is from somebody who had severe hypertensive microvascular disease involving, I think this was an evacuation of clot from the basal ganglia. And the reason I like to show this picture was that the term lipohyalinosis, as Miller-Fisher coined it, implies that there are both lipid-laden macrophages and hyalinization in smooth muscle cells in that sclerotic vessel wall. And indeed, all of those elements are here. So there is collagen, there are foamy macrophages or lipid-laden macrophages, and there is even some degree of smooth muscle cell thickening here as well. And this is from an autopsy specimen. We know that individuals can have a lot of lacunar infarcts in the subcortical white matter, which leads to a dementing syndrome in people who are chronically hypertensive. And in those, you see again this onion skin type thickening of the vessels in the deep central white matter. What's the eponym that's sometimes given to people who have multiple lacunar infarcts that predominantly are in the subcortical white matter? Very good. Binswanger's subcortical leukoencephalopathy. So the Binswanger's disease, and we'll talk a little bit about, if time allows, about white matter disease and dementing disorders related to microvascular disease. So these days we see a lot of interesting autopsies on individuals who have modern stroke therapies. especially interventional therapies, MERCY device patients, or patients who've undergone treatment with a MERCY device, the Penumbra device, all kinds of interesting instrumentation, thromboembolectomies, stenting, and so on. Now, as an autopsy pathologist, I'm the first one to realize that these are a highly selected population and that many patients do extremely well with these therapies. But it's quite interesting to see the few patients who do come to autopsy and to see what is the abnormality in their vessels. So this is actually one of the first MERCY device patients that we encountered some years ago. And this is actually from a published paper, so I won't spend too much time on this. This was an article published in Stroke about a year ago, where we analyzed the findings in five patients who died after MERCY device or Penumbra device treatment. You can see a severely atherosclerotic middle cerebral artery stem here, just before its bifurcation or trifurcation in the Sylvian fissure. Quite a bit of atheroma. This is a vessel stained with a stain for Elastica Van Giessen. Can anyone tell me what the abnormality is in the lower two panels? Very good. It's a dissection. This is the internal elastic lamina, which is stained using the Elastica Van Giessen stain. And the internal elastic lamina is sitting in the middle of the lumen in a place it definitely should not be sitting. And this is actually somebody who underwent a dissection during or immediately after the thrombectomy procedure. And what's always interesting to me about this case is that the actual dissection seemed to be in the relatively healthy part of the vessel. In fact, the endothelium overlying the plaque was really intact and quite normal. This is actually a dissection. It's the only one we've seen after a MERCY device procedure, but that's what it is. This is another case of somebody who had a massive middle MCA territory infarct involving the left cerebral hemisphere, focally hemorrhagic, so there was evidence of emboli in the vessel branches. And you can see a severely atherosclerotic circle of Willis, all of the branches dissected out from the circle of Willis here. Interestingly enough, there was a relatively recent thrombus in that vessel. This is a section stained with an antibody to smooth muscle actin to highlight one of the things I mentioned previously, and that is, again, that cushion of cells immediately beneath the lumen and overlying the lipid material in the atherosclerotic plaque is really composed of smooth muscle cell proliferation. This is actually our longest survivor. He survived about 32 or 33 days after the thrombectomy device. He had actually had an embolic occlusion. He had atrial fibrillation, embolic occlusion of his middle cerebral artery Y, or the stem. So this is the middle cerebral artery, the two branches of the middle cerebral artery, and this is actually a thrombus occluding that stem. And this is actually a thrombus that is quite well organized, which is why I show this. So there's actually ingrowth of cells from the wall of the vessel, and it's quite a well-organized thrombus. And he had a fairly large infarct involving the middle cerebral territory, and you can see that liquefactive necrosis here. So we're going to be seeing more and more of these. And what's interesting is that we now see occasionally individuals who have fairly widespread embolic disease who've received a lot of interventional procedures or just had a lot of angiograms. And it seems that there might be some material from the catheters that are used in those angiograms that actually embolizes distally. And one of our former fellows actually undertook a very systematic study of this and showed that there would very often be multinucleated giant cells around that material and it could actually be polarized in some situations, and it's really not that rare a phenomenon. A couple of words about infarcts of the spinal cord. Of course, whereas infarcts of the brain are extremely common, ischemic infarcts of the spinal cord are extraordinarily rare, and there usually is some other etiology. We quite rarely see atherosclerosis of the anterior spinal artery, or certainly we rarely see atherosclerosis of such a severity as to produce an ischemic infarct in the spinal cord. But there are other risk factors for infarcts of the spinal cord, dissection of the aorta, for example. Vasculitides, primary angiitis of the CNS that can involve the spinal cord, or there can be hematologic abnormalities like coagulopathies that actually lead to infarcts in the spinal cord. And a reminder that the spinal cord, of course, receives its blood supply from the anterior spinal artery, which is a fusion of branches from the vertebral arteries. And that spinal, and also from posterior spinal arteries, And that blood flow to the spinal cord is supplemented by the reticular feeders that come off the aorta. So if you've ever seen an aorta at autopsy, particularly in a young individual, you know that there are little reticular feeders that come off the aorta all the way down the aorta. And of course, if those become occluded, or if there's a dissection that tears through those ostia to the reticular feeders, that's going to make the spinal cord vulnerable to ischemic infarcts. There is a rare entity in the spinal cord, which is called arteriosclerotic myelopathy, which is maybe a bit of a misnomer. But what happens in those individuals is those are individuals who have severe eggshell-like atherosclerosis of the aorta, and they throw small atheroemboli through the radicular feeders into the spinal cord. And they really present like a progressive myelopathy, but their real disease is not in the spinal cord, but it's in the aorta, and they are embolizing atheromatous material to the spinal cord. And this is just another demonstration of the blood supply to the spinal cord. And in the cross section, again, the anterior spinal artery probably supplies about the anterior two-thirds of the spinal cord. Posterior spinal arteries usually supply the dorsal columns, maybe the substantia gelatinosa here, maybe part of the corticospinal tracts. And this is a spinal cord infarct that we encountered now about 2 or 3 years ago, a very unfortunate young Hispanic woman who had factor V Leiden deficiency, so she actually had a hypercoagulable state. And of all the arteries in the in her body to decide to thrombose, she thrombosed her anterior spinal artery right near its origin. So she basically became acutely quadriplegic. She survived for about 2 weeks, then eventually died of a pneumonia. At the time of autopsy, she had this devastating infarct that had taken out about the anterior two-thirds of her cervical spinal cord. So that it was literally just falling apart in just a bag of macrophages. And here it is at a higher power, just two regions of that cervical spinal cord. And sure enough, she had a thrombus in the anterior spinal artery. This is somebody who developed a more indolent progressive myelopathy. The neurologist couldn't figure out what was going on. Eventually he died, and what we found was evidence of multiple smaller infarcts in the spinal cord, not a huge devastating infarct similar to what we saw in the previous case, but small areas of necrosis in different regions of the spinal cord. This is a myelin stained section. This is a section stained with a macrophage stain, which always demonstrates histiocytes are an area of a subacute area of necrosis. And indeed, what he had was evidence of a primary angiitis of the CNS, which involved very minimally his cerebral hemispheres and his brainstem, but involved very extensively vessels in the spinal cord, which is extremely rare. So here's actually the anterior spinal artery with numerous inflammatory cells in the vessel wall. Here you see fibrinoid necrosis of the vessel wall. And the angiitis had been going on for some time because this is actually a section of his anterior spinal artery. And you can see that there's a huge amount of granulation tissue, which is reparative tissue, that is almost completely occluding the lumen of that anterior spinal artery. So a very rare cause of spinal cord infarct, including many spinal arteries, predominantly spinal arteries, with resultant spinal cord infarcts. There's a very rare condition that affects the spinal cord, which is called Foix-Alajuwenin syndrome. Does anyone know what that is? Sorry? So the other name for Foix-Alajuwenin is, it's very rare, I've only ever seen one case in consultation, it's called angiodysgenetic myelomalacia. But what it is basically a very weird malformation of the spinal cord that leads to progressive occlusion of vessels and eventually multiple areas of necrosis in the spinal cord. It really presents as a progressive myelopathy. Extraordinarily rare, and I've only seen it, as I say, in one consult case and in textbooks and at meetings. I was going to talk just for a couple of minutes about small vessel disease and the relationship between small vessel disease and ischemic vascular dementia. The reason small vessel disease has become very hot, and it's a very, very topic of great interest to people in dementia, in the dementia field, is, of course, the genetics of it. Because the genetics of large vessel disease, atherosclerosis, even hypertensive microvascular disease, is extremely complicated, multifactorial, polygenic. It's very difficult to separate out the individual genes that cause microvascular disease. By contrast, we now have at least two or three types of microvascular disease in the brain that have a clear-cut autosomal dominant genetics, and so that's kind of giving genetic clues to understanding microvascular disease. So, you know, the geneticists always kind of steal the day. So the genetic paradigms in studying cerebral microvascular disease are kind of becoming very important. IVD stands for ischemic vascular dementia, which I know you're not going to deal with, the neurologists are going to deal with that, but you will deal with microvascular disease that can cause that dementia. Very heterogeneous neuropathologic substrates, which is why it's difficult to study. And we don't know what actually is the result of small vessel disease short of an ischemic infarct. So we don't know what's happening in the brain parenchyma around badly injured blood vessels or abnormal blood vessels that can lead to changes in the brain that don't necessarily look like an ischemic infarct, but are abnormalities in the brain. And that's being looked at in animal models. As I mentioned, there are relatively few genetically determined syndromes that yield genes of interest in looking at microvascular disease. There, of course, are many familial types of amyloid angiopathy, but there are actually three entities that have kind of captured the imagination of geneticists. CADASIL, which stands for cerebral autosomal dominant arteriopathy with subcortical infarcts and leukoencephalopathy, seen much more commonly in Europe than in North America, or at least we don't see them at autopsy here. But CADASIL is quite common in particularly Northern Europe. And Hearn's, which was discovered at UCLA, and Hearn's is called hereditary endotheliopathy with retinopathy, nephropathy, and stroke-like episodes. And Hearn's, there's only ever been one autopsy on a Hearn's patient that was done here. CADASIL, there's lots of autopsy data on. And you might think if there is a CADASIL, there must also be, surely there is also a CARASIL, cerebral autosomal recessive arteriopathy with subcortical infarcts and leukoencephalopathy. And indeed there is, but there's only, it's a very small number of families and they're all in Japan. So whereas CADASIL is in Western populations, CARASIL seems to be only in Japan. And the one case I've had the opportunity to study was just sent to me by courtesy of the group in Japan that, looks at this entity. But just to show you that microvascular disease is really, really important as a function of aging. So this will probably be the last slide I show. So the bar graph here summarizes, this is actually data from our Easton Center, our Alzheimer's Center. So obviously these are patients who are selected for having cognitive impairment, memory impairment, dementia. But it summarizes in each decile of life, or in each decile of death when we do the autopsies, what percentage of individuals have a certain type of vascular disease. Now obviously in this population it would be selected against people who have cystic infarcts in the brain, but you'll notice that the one thing that increases rather logarithmically with age is the presence of small infarcts in the brain. So that by the time we look at the brains of individuals over 90 years of age, an age that we would all like to live to, we can see that almost 40% of individuals over the age of 90 years have microinfarcts in the brain. And so there's a lot of interest in what are the neuropathologic abnormalities that can actually lead to those microinfarcts in the brain. And certainly amyloid angiopathy is one of the abnormalities, but also other types of microvascular disease can cause microinfarcts as well. And I think I'm actually going to stop there. I can give a separate talk on microvascular disease at another time where I talk about some of the genetic abnormalities. Again, those are really more the interest of the neurologists and the geneticists, but you might get some questions on your boards on CADASIL and Hearn's. So.